anticipation of the tremendously increasing importance of religion in the life of the average citizen, that maybe we should look back a little to some of the things that were happening about 2,000 years ago. If you will remember from the concordances and so forth, that by the middle of the first century, nearly all of the original disciples had passed on. Of the 12, 11 were martyred. The 12th, John, retired to the Isle of Patmos, where he worked, some think, upon the fourth gospel, and others upon the book of the Revelation. Out of that original group, there was no one of the original group that survived to carry on the work. Also, if we study the various records of the Acts of the Apostles and so forth, we find out that Christianity was then a series of little isolated congregations living in a world that did not understand and could hardly tolerate them, and in many cases persecuted them outrageously. The church as we know it does not exist in this pattern. There was no Christianity at that time. There was a message, and all of the messengers had vanished. Now, apparently, there was not among these messengers any essential glimpse of a worldwide message. Most of the little communities that did exist were in the area where the older beliefs were still well entrenched. And as a result, they were simply a sect or a division or a minor revolution or a reform in the existing patterns. There was no real concept of a great mission, a great individual surviving revelation. And then for some reason, something happened that is very difficult to understand from the Bible records. A person by the name of Saul came along, and he persecuted the Christians thoroughly and mercilessly. He was basically, however, apparently a perfectly sincere individual who believed that the religion he had was the one to be protected. Saul had another and one or two other interesting specialties. One peculiarity of Paul that made him strangely useful was that he was a citizen of Rome. He was born in Tarsus, and when the Romans settled down in front of Tarsus to take the city, instead of a bloody war, the elders of Tarsus went out and voluntarily said, "Let us keep the peace. You can have the city. Let us not kill people." And the Romans were so delightful in this respect and so happy to have this happen that they proclaimed all of the citizens of Tarsus as citizens of Rome. Now, this was not an empty title. It carried with it great privileges, privileges of travel, privileges of protection by the various departments of the Roman government. It made it illegal to imprison a Roman citizen without a trial and without proper legal following. Also, a Roman citizen could not be crucified, hanged, or in any other way tortured. If it was a major crime and he had to die, he had to be decapitated. No torturing was permitted of a Roman citizen. Now, Paul had this peculiar something, and it was possibly that peculiarity that changed his name from Saul to Paul. As Paul, he was now a Latin citizen. He was also a man of good family, and he was an educated man. He is known to have spoken Latin, and he probably had some knowledge of Greek, if we are to remember his sermon in Athens. So Paul was a man with various accomplishments, but with a deadly prejudice. Yet here was an emergency. And in an emergency, heaven very often makes a pronouncement on its own. It was not at all likely that the little community at that time of Christians would have voluntarily selected Saul to become their spokesman. But on the road to Damascus, a mystery occurred. As he was riding toward Damascus to persecute the Christians, Paul was suddenly struck with a mysterious vision. A tremendous experience occurred to him. There was a great turmoil in his own heart. An incredible, miraculous occurrence. And in the midst of this occurrence came the words, "Why persecutest thou me?" Paul didn't see Christ. He only heard the words. But he was thrown from his horse, fell on the ground in a state of almost suspended animation, and stricken blind. Well, when he was in this condition, he was carried into Damascus and was treated and restored to health by the little Christian community that he had come to persecute. This was resulted in the tremendous conversion of Paul. He now presented to the world a person tremendously and devoutly moved by an experience which happened to himself. He was not converted by any ordinary means. He was converted by an act of the divine will. And in this state, apparently, it was his duty and his moral obligation to change his point of view and serve the cause he had attempted to destroy. And Paul did exactly this, and he became one of the most important spokesmen of the new Christian community. In fact, he was really the source of a Christian community. He suddenly picked a local faith out of the mystery and sand and dust of the Near East and laid the foundations of a worldwide religion that was to endure to this time and is still having a tremendous effect upon the cultural life and religious hopes of mankind. So Paul became the leader of a branch of the early revelation. And we find Christianity dividing very early into two great schools, one of them being the Jerusalem school and the other being the Greek school. The Greek school was led by Paul. The Jerusalem school was led by Peter. And in Rome, Peter and Paul died side by side for the faith that they had served. Peter crucified because he was not a citizen of Rome, and Paul decapitated. But the foundation was laid of two schools of Christian thought, one founded largely upon the Old Testament, and the other founded upon something else, probably Paul's knowledge of Greek and Latin culture. In other words, Peter was working with Jesus. And Paul had visualized Christ. And it was the Jesus of Peter and the Christ of Paul that became the two great forces in the development of Christianity. The Christianity of Peter was very conservative. It was very literal. It was a friend that was being honored. Peter knew Jesus. The disciples all knew him and were deeply personally involved in the story of the man, the life of the man, the things they had seen him do, the wonders he had wrought, the teachings he had given, and the final martyrdom which he experienced. Add to this the mystery of the resurrection, and the disciples of Jesus were a small group who loved him, knew him, and in a mysterious way thought of the religion mostly in terms of him, and in terms of him as a person walking with them on the dusty roads of Judea. Paul, as far as we can find out, never saw Jesus. He never met him. He did not know him personally. Therefore, there was a different point of view here. Peter was thinking constantly of the man that walked with him. Paul was thinking of something else. Paul was in the position to lay the foundations of a great religion, because while he was converted completely, he was not bound to the personality of the teacher. And in this particular case, this was very significant. So we find Paul gradually building the foundations of what we might term mystic Christianity. Now, the question has been raised as to the source of the thinking which influenced Paul's mind in connection with the church. If we read the Corinthians and Thessalonians, we realize almost immediately that we are dealing with a person who had a knowledge, understanding, and an insight outside of the area of conservative theology. He was a man who was worldly wise and experienced, and now suddenly, deeply, profoundly dedicated. As obvious, the obvious facts remain that the mysticism of Paul began to change the shape of the Christian faith. There was to be, of course, the Jesus of Peter, but the Christ of Paul was not a person. The Christ was an eternal principle, a divine power. It was not a person. A person could have that power, but the power was not the person. The divine principle of infinite love was far beyond the control of any individual. And Paul was reaching out to the experience of the love of Christ rather than of his physical, historical, biographical setting of the faith. It was gradually aware, Paul was aware probably in his own time, for we are aware of the same thing now, that there's a great deal of difference between a nominal worshiper and a true Christian. There is a great deal of difference between a person being baptized and that same person being consecrated. These are not the same things, although they have come to be considered as such. We have long and many times regarded a person as belonging to a faith simply because he was born into it, or because he accepted it, or because he was baptized. These things, to Peter, were the very important parts of the doctrine, and they have descended down to us today in Syrian Christianity. But to Paul, these things were not so important. And I remember one afternoon I spent several hours with a group of retired clergymen who were living in retirement in the home set aside by their sect for their habitation in their closing years. Each one of these men had been a missionary or a preacher in the field. Some were very well educated. Some were very dimly educated. Some were considerably younger in spirit than others. But each one in his own way went into the story of his career and his ministry. And of course, the great pride was the number of persons they had converted. So there was a little competition among these ministers, retired ministers, as to which one of them had converted the most. And each was very proud of the fact that he had brought hundreds to God. And this was the real reason for his life of happiness and his sense of satisfaction, which would carry him to the end of his days. On the other hand, there were certain doubts about this matter. Some of these ministers admitted frankly that conversion was not as satisfactory as it might be. In other words, if you really wanted to set up a pattern of capturing relapsed sinners and bring them back to the faith, you had to do something much more than convert them. And the only thing that most of these ministers could do was reconvert them. So every year the minister went through and picked up those who had fallen by the way and converted them again. And the majority of converts had to be saved at least once a year, or they wouldn't make it. Now, this was the point that Paul evidently noticed, possibly in the very small communities of early Christians, that there were many in these communities who were devout but had very little evidence of insight or understanding. They believed, but they lived exactly as they would have lived if they hadn't believed. They accepted the responsibility, perhaps were willing to face martyrdom, but in their daily transactions of life, the Spirit of Christ was not present. It was something that was far away and was miraculously conjured into existence by the rites, rituals, and ceremonies of the church. Paul recognized this point, namely, that according to Greek philosophy, he was obviously well trained in Platonism and also probably in Alexandrian metaphysics on this mysticism or Hermetic philosophy. These things come through his writings, and if we want to say, well, that's just not possible, let us remember that the Apocalypse of John is also definitely of pagan origin. And for this reason, Martin Luther did not want it to be included in the Bible. But John obviously had contact with secret organizations and mystical sects in the area. And this seems also to have been true of Paul, that he had certain contacts. We know that he was, to some degree, an initiate of some rites, because he describes the circumstances to us. He may have been a Dionysian artificer or an Essene, because he says, I am a wise master builder, a term which has always been associated with some of these esoteric orders. Regardless of whether he had a formal membership or not, he had a knowledge. And his knowledge led him directly into Christian mysticism. And this led again into the foundation of a world religion. The mysticism of Paul was based upon one very basic and essential point: the Christ in you, the hope of glory. Now, this is something that, while we hear much about it in the Testaments today, we see very little evidence of contemplating the mystery of it. That we are no longer speaking of the Jesus of the roads to Jerusalem. We are no longer speaking about the Christ in heaven as the Son of God. We are speaking about something else: the Christ in ourselves. And that the power of the creative Trinity, by which we are brought into existence, the power of God in us, comes in the form of a Trinitarian invocation, a mystery of three in one, in which the power of the Godhead, as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, becomes part of each of us when we are born. That we are actually the living temples of a living God. We are ourselves the keeper of the Christianity that we claim to believe. We are in our own person and in our own flesh, serving or not serving. This has nothing to do really with our attendance at the church. This may be good. It may help us in time of stress. And the insight that we seek would not prevent us from going to church, but it would move Christianity from the church to our own hearts, where it belongs. And it would make the church no substitute for the good life. It would not permit an individual through either confirmation or ordination to feel that there was any way he could escape the duties of daily life. Now, we see today a billion Christians, perhaps a little more. This is the world's largest single religion. And yet, among these billion people, we have several nations at war at the present time. We have leaders all claiming some form of religious affiliation who are not living the creeds that they claim to belong to. We know, for instance, that this is not only true of Christianity, but of other religions. Wherever there is a religion, there is a nominal membership and an active membership. A nominal membership hopes for the best and places all faith upon a membership or an acceptance or an acknowledgement. This is the point that Paul was very definitely attempting to attack. It was not the fact that we become a nominal believer that does us any particular good. It is only the degree to which this believing changes conduct, changes our way of life, corrects the infirmities of the soul and the body, and gives us a new sense of significance in life. That each one of us, in a way, is a church, and the humanity together is the great congregation. The Christ in us is therefore a spirit in us that may be under various names. The same spirit that we call Christ may be called Buddha by somebody else, or might be called Muhammad. We don't say what these people or these beings can be called, but regardless of what they are named, it is their works by means of which we prove our membership. It is only when we keep the rules, keep the laws, and keep the peace that we are fulfilling any form of religious acceptability, anything that will give us the right to consider that we are bound in the right direction. So we all come down now to the 20th century, where the house of Paul has become very largely Protestant Christianity. That of Peter is the Eastern Church, or the Roman or Greek Christianity. These two great sections, or great schisms, are essentially worshiping the same thing. They are using the same words and the same names, but one worships as an act of faith, and the other worships as a personal character and a dedicated daily existence. So that very largely now we think of true Christianity much in the way that Paul has given it to us, namely that it is a way of life, and that it basically makes little difference whether we've ever been confirmed or not. We can be a Christian without a church, but there can never be a real church without Christians. So we have a tremendous challenge, the challenge of inventorying our own way of life. We go down some sawdust trail, we accept the gospel, declare ourselves converted, and then what do? We probably go home and go to a picnic in the afternoon or sit down in front of our favorite television program, and after a little while wish we could turn it off and haven't got the strength to do so. Actually, also we still have that feud with the neighbor. We still have trouble getting along with our relatives. We are also involved in business transactions that might be a bit shady. And there are very many cases in which famous gangsters have been buried with the full ritual of their faith. There's been no recognition of the fact that faith has to change people. That Christianity is a changing of an individual for the better. It is not simply something he says, I'm a Christian, looks around and goes on and does what he intended to do in the first place. Also, it is true that when they gather together, only those really belong in whom the light of Christianity is very obvious and evident in daily conduct. I have known a few persons who I believe were really very good Christians, in the best sense of the word. One of them had originally been an atheist, same as Paul, perhaps, with a little different twist. But he had never had any particular religion in his life, but he came into the presence of a tragedy in the life of a friend and was suddenly converted to the important fact that human beings are living in this world to help each other, not to help themselves off of what other people have. He suddenly realized that the only useful thing that a person can do is serve. So he became a very good servant of other people in need and in trouble. And gradually his material fortunes, I guess, declined a little, but his number of sincere friends and those ready to serve him and serve with him increased every day. He had a long life and a happy one, simply because he tried to live every day as religion would have inspired him to live. He believed in trying hard to be useful. He did not pray for wealth. He did not pray for happiness. He prayed for the privilege of being useful. And he did it all in the name of God, because he said it was the God in him that had to do the work. So we find people who heal that way. We find people who teach that way. Some of them never join any church, but because the church is in them, they are good Christians or good Buddhists or good Muslims, whatever it may be. Then we find this great fringe of people to whom the religion is something of dignity, something to be respected, even to be admired, but not to be applied in personal daily living, because it interfered with the fulfillment of selfish interests, attitudes, and appetites. We are suffering today in Christendom from about as much moral dishonesty as has ever plagued this world at one time. We are constantly aware of the situation around us in which people we have trusted have deceived us, people we have worked with have variously exploited us, and those who have been given places of responsibility have abused them. We see all this. And yet a great part of it is taking place within what would be called nominally a Christian world. Most of these people, if put to the test, would insist that they are Christians. But it has never enabled them to rise above the various problems of personal living. We know this because we have them come here all the time and ask my assistance in various ways. They're in all kinds of trouble. They admit they're in trouble. They admit they did wrong. But it never seemingly goes deeply enough for them to perform the miracle of revelation within themselves. They do not seem to have the courage to apply the principles of life to the daily living community responsibilities. So we could say, as Paul would have put it, that it was time for us to call upon internal resources. And that would end another problem that is very discouraging, and that is the constant clash of creeds. People who belong to one sect do not even speak to members of other sects. They don't acknowledge any point of view but their own. Whereas if all of these people were living from within themselves, there could be no competition of this kind. They would live according to their own ideal of what was right. And the resulting happiness, the resulting peace of mind, the resulting security arising from living up to your belief would be far more important than trying to live down to a better belief and never getting there. Actually, therefore, we move religion out of the churches primarily. The churches can definitely secure certain values. In fact, the churches constitute places of union or reunion of people with sincere beliefs. But we take religion out of institutions and put it into individuals where it belongs. So we can take the Ten Commandments and look them over. We can take the commandments of Christ and look them over. Or the wise statements of Paul and look them over. And we know that all of these teachers advocated peace, that we should live with our brothers in harmony and in concord. And yet the Christian world is not at peace. It has probably been never less peaceful. All over the world, individuals attending similar churches are at each other's throats. Why? Because the actual religion which they preach is not in themselves. It's in a book or in a creed or on an altar, but it is not in them. So we think it's very important at this time, in Easter particularly, to give an additional thought to this Christ in us, that is the hope of glory, and that we should try to find some way to lift the level of our own thinking and living. Now, to some people, this might be a difficult thing to do. And of course, most of the, as the Bible tells us, the more worldly goods we have and the more worldly position we occupy, the more difficult it is to live a good life. Temptations become too numerous, the pressure of ulterior motives too strong. But we have here young people growing up on narcotics. These people, they come from Christian families. And some of these narcotic sufferers actually go to church. I've known them. But they don't have the courage or the strength to break the habit that is breaking them. So everywhere we find some beautiful thoughts. And today, all over Christendom, there will be great rejoicing in the privilege of living in a Christian world. Therefore, let us try to make this not only a privilege, but a responsibility. Let us try not to ruin this Christian world by our own personal misrepresentations of facts and realities. After all, there is no reason why intelligent people, dedicated people, and responsible people should not be able to mingle in gentle communion of hope and purpose. There is too much of certain internal things that come in way. Religion is an internal thing. And one way we may have to approach it in life is through a psychological study. We know that people with poor dispositions are sick. We know that an individual who nurses a grudge long enough will become a personification of that grudge. We know that individuals who do not correct certain mistakes that they make shorten their lives, increase the problems of sickness, and also destroy the lives of their families. We know selfish parents who try to dominate their children far too long. We notice selfish children who grow up and neglect the parents. We know some that go out and take a job and neglect their children. Everywhere something is happening that isn't good, solid Christianity. Now, this doesn't mean that Christianity is a slave driver. Christianity is meaningless unless it makes you happy. If it doesn't make you happy as a person serving with others for the common good, then there's something wrong with your standard of happiness. The Christianity is not a slave driver. It is not a merciless dictator. And various churches of different periods and times that have tried to usurp control over the temporal life of everything have all gone down because it was not reasonable or correct. But there is a definite need right now in this time when we are talking about reorganizing society to get at some of the facts. We've simply recently had quite a bad expose of television clergymen. We find that the truth, the principle, the spirit has been neglected in order to justify unreasonable profits. So that instead of serving God, we are mostly serving mammon, as we were warned in the Old Testament might happen. We have, therefore, every reason to say that it's time to really give a little thought to the real life that we are supposed to live. One thing that might help a lot of people in this particular problem would be if they had a little niche or a little corner somewhere, even in a single room apartment, where there was some little sense of sacredness, a little sacred picture or an image, a sacred book, a display of some sacred object, and a regular period of consecration and concentration in which the individual communes inwardly upon the meaning of the symbols which he has assembled. In religion, symbolism is the open door to communion. It is the way in which the individual gradually becomes aware of the beauty and wisdom of life. Symbolism, therefore, opens the door to the understanding heart. And as the mind and the emotions and the body come into tune with reality, then they find that divine power that is within us can flow forth. We are all endowed with life. If we were not, we couldn't breathe, we couldn't live, we couldn't do anything. And yet this life that we are living with and from and by is not simply something that is on a meter somewhere created by water going over a dam. This life in us is a part of the universal reality. It is infinite life. It is life in all things. And regardless of what it is, from the most noble and heroic soul to the least insect, bird, creeping thing, all life is one. All life is one infinite resource manifesting through an infinitude of branches and manifestations. And this life that is in us is essentially sacred. It is not secular. When we destroy life of any kind, needlessly and thoughtlessly, we are only damaging one life. There is only one. And this one life in us not only provides us with the means of getting around, doing our daily jobs and things of this nature, but also gives us the opportunity for introspection, for the internal investigation of ourselves, a constant watching of that which we do and what we say. It isn't a neighbor prying on our privacies. It is ourselves looking into our own innards to find out what private vices we are carefully concealing under the general heading of the good Christian life and existence. I think one of the points we have to face is that we must all finally prove that we are potential Christs. Sometime in the great farness of things, sometime beyond the recognition that we now know, the godness in ourselves will come of age. Somewhere along the line, there is the time when that is that divinity which is locked within us will no longer be held behind a stern misuse of resources, but will come forth. That which comes forth from within is good. That with which we struggle on the outside can very often be very bad. One thing is certain, however, someday we are going to be converted, as Paul was, by a vision, by a tremendous personal experience of some kind. And without that personal experience, the true mystery of religion is seldom fulfilled. Now, this great experience may not be anything as stupendous or unbelievable as the vision that came to Paul. But there is something in our own lives that comes along that we suddenly realize that religion is the only real and living answer. Something tells us where the solution is to a problem. I know we've read many letters from people who live alone, lonely people of advanced years, who have no friends or relatives that are close, but live in a sort of community charity, even though they may have enough money to live independently as long as they live. These people have within themselves very little. They are sometimes badly mistaken in their allegiances. They become neurotic. They lose all contact with human life. They retire into themselves in a kind of a haze of despondency. These people have never realized or do not realize that infinite life is just as much in them as it is in the sun, moon, and stars. The infinite power, as long as we breathe, bestows upon us the privilege of doing things, of continuing valuable labors, of subscribing to the assistance of others, to improvement of our own natures, and to the gradual conquest of the negative attitudes that plague ourselves. All these things are part of a good Christian life. And on this day of Easter, this resurrection morn, many people feel that the resurrection of Christ had to be symbolical because it was just not possible for a dead person to rise physically from his own grave. But if you read it right, it is possible because we are all dead persons. We're walking around mostly in a state of half-existence. And yet when we begin to realize the values of life, There is a resurrection in ourselves. Many have risen from the deadness of materialism to the liveness of understanding and insight. Each of us is capable of a resurrection and restoration of that which is best, noblest, and proper for a human being to cultivate. So if we are actually not only children of God, but personifications and embodiments of deity, then there are responsibilities that come to us. It is no longer the communion cup or the sanctified wafer. It is the individual himself as the living vessel, the living symbol of this great confirmation of spiritual reality. Each individual taking the journey from here to there, making the journey as found in Neoplatonism, with which apparently Paul was well informed, the Neoplatonism that tells us that we are all on one great journey, and that that journey is the great journey home. We are all exiles somewhere. We are all living on the circumference of a life, but one by one we move gradually toward the center, toward the point from which we came in the beginning. We become journeyers in the valley of the shadow, but we are going home. We are going home not to idleness, not to be carried away on flowery beds of ease or something of that kind. We are going home to the full appreciation and understanding of our own natures. We are going home to the realization that each of us has a divine power within him, which can be used to improve the rest of himself and can become a major factor in the improvement of society. There is legislation all the time, now probably more and more, of what to do about schooling, what to do about politics, what to do about stocks and bonds, all solved without any consideration for the reality of life. Behind every stockbroker and every schoolteacher and every pupil, there is this unit of divine energy that makes them alive. Without this energy, there'd be no stockbrokers, there'd be no teachers, there'd be no broken homes, because there would be nothing. It is the fact that within each of us there is something that is big enough to solve our problem that becomes a tremendous realization. It makes us suddenly realize that we can achieve in the terms of truth that which is necessary to make us useful instruments of a divine purpose. We will not start thinking on how good we are or how wonderful we are, but rather to realize that we are all channels of the one good which never changes, the one reality that can never die, and the one code of law that can never be broken. And when we begin to realize this, we see ourselves as children of one great family. We see ourselves as the body of deity, and as the Essenes and also the Gnostics pointed out, if you put all the souls in the world together in one place, the answer is they are God. For everything that is separate is part of that which is indivisible in substance and divisible only in appearances. So here now, with another Eastic with us and another restatement of our belief in the reality and purpose of the divine missionary, we could perhaps find it a profitable thought to see what we can do in this year to open the door to the best of ourselves that is locked within, that we can gradually become so worthy of a better life that it cannot be kept from us. That we will get what we deserve, and that has been our trouble. We've been getting what we deserve, and the time has come to try to deserve something better. So we can start, and I don't think anyone will have a hard time finding something to work on, because most people have a few little errors here and there that will not take a monumental effort, but which will require a little personal thought.